This week on Behind the Lens. A New Orleans charter school surprised parents with plans to move to a four-day school week. We'll talk about the impact on students and teachers. Also, affordable housing. The New Orleans City Council approved zoning plans for a housing development in the Bywater. We'll have the details. And federal prosecutors have charged a local developer with conspiracy to commit bank fraud in connection with the billion-dollar collapse of First NBC Bank. Part of the alleged scheme involves the Lake Terrace Shopping Center in Gentilly. I'll talk to Lens co-founder Karen Gadbois, who has followed the site for years. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
A New Orleans charter school, Friends of King, is moving to a four-day school week. The school says it will improve academics, save money, and attract teachers, but critics say it's a challenge for parents who need to secure childcare. Marta Jusen has been following the story. Marta, when was this proposal for a four-day school week announced?
It's unclear exactly when Friends of King brought up this idea, but it does appear on their March board meeting minutes, so we know that they talked about it then. And we don't know exactly when they told parents, other than we did see an email that went out to parents last week after we published a story about the calendar.
So it wasn't so much announced as it came out.
Yes, it appears it was revealed, and the district says they made the school go ahead and tell parents.
How did parents react to that?
We didn't get any specific parent reaction, but we've heard reactions in the community ranging from people are excited about a more flexible work schedule to people are concerned about finding a fifth day of childcare during the week. But Friends of King says it is going to have an optional program. The Advocate reported that on the fifth day. It's unclear at this point how much that might cost or where exactly it would be hosted or what it would entail.
So how would a four-day school week at Friends of King work? What does that look like?
If you look at their calendar, there's a red mark on every single Monday, so they're not going to have school on Mondays. They're just going to have longer days on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and they're going to go later in the school year. They're going to go an extra hour every day on Tuesdays through Fridays, and high school students are going to go an extra hour and 15 minutes, and it looks like they're going to go about a month longer in the school year, so they're going to go into the first week of June instead of early May.
So how does the state manage the amount of time that kids are required to be in school? You know, you mentioned that Friends of King has this, they're making arrangements to extend the days by more time and also the school year by more time. What does the state require?
So the state does have a requirement. You have to go to school for 360 minutes a day for 177 days a year. But any school can kind of adjust that amount of time as long as it comes out to be the same amount of minutes over the length of the school year.
What are the benefits of a four-day school week?
Advocates say that it's attractive for teachers. People are interested in having this fifth day to take care of personal things, doctor's appointments, or just have some time off, or for kids to do homework. Critics are worried that it's going to be a struggle for families who have to line up a fifth day of care, especially if that's going to cost extra money.
And there's a few things there. So is there actually a benefit for kids to have, you know, a shorter school week? Kids' attention spans are a concern throughout the day, so you are forcing a longer day on them, but then you're giving them an extra free day. So where does that balance fall?
I think the jury's still out on that. Districts across the country actually have been trying this, and some say that they've seen improvement. Others say that, yes, kids are getting tired in the afternoons at school, so they worried that with their attention kind of dropping off, maybe they're missing out on some things.
You know, adults are always talking about, like, I wish I only had a four-day work week. But in terms of kids, while, you know, they could use that fifth day to do homework and work on school stuff, chances are if they're not properly supervised, you know, they're not really going to be encouraged to work on school stuff on their own.
Yeah, I think, and that's going to be up to the kid, right? So we might have some very driven students who are studying during the day, but we also might have some kids who just want to be out exercising, and not that that's a bad thing at all. But it will be really interesting to see if Friends of King does see academic gains, and it'll probably be a couple years before we actually can see the reality of that.
So most professionals work, you know, a five-day work week, 40 hours, and while school isn't supposed to be a replacement for childcare, when those schedules are compatible, it can be really helpful. So what can parents possibly do if they have to work 5 days a week and their kids are now only in school for four?
I think people are going to have to get creative. So you're either lining up one day of childcare. Friends of King might provide some programming that day, so obviously that would probably be attractive to parents. It'll be interesting to see what it is and how much it costs, whether it costs anything. But I do think it's definitely an opportunity for interest-based programming that day. That's an opportunity for kids to maybe dive into something that they're really interested in. One interesting note there is that this is only 3 schools out of the entire district, whereas in France, for example, they have a national 4-day week, and they take off Wednesdays. So then, you know, you can think of the demand there might be for programming on Wednesdays if the entire country's kids are out of school, versus we're going to have a much smaller population, a fraction of the city's kids. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of programming pops up.
And what about the impact of kids who get, you know, free or discounted meals at school?
We're not exactly sure yet. I have not asked Friends of King that, nor have I heard any plans that they've announced. I know in some districts where this happens, they send extra food home on Thursdays if kids are taking off Fridays. So that'll be interesting to see. Or, you know, maybe Friends of King's just going to open its kitchen.
And, you know, there are other schools in the state that have gone to a 4-day school week. Has it been successful for any of them?
Some of the districts are pretty high performing where they've gone to the 4-day week, and parents say they really like it to be able to take care of personal stuff and, you know, doctor's appointments. But another district, actually the one that Orleans Parish Superintendent Henderson Lewis came from, actually went back to a 5-day week because he was worried that kids weren't going to be academically prepared for higher state standards. So when he came in, he reverted back to the 5-day week.
Schools in New Orleans have, you know, this one app application process. When was this announced in terms of when parents were able to decide what school they wanted their kids to go to?
The one app process starts in the fall, and the deadline for submitting applications to the school you want to go to is at the end of February. And when this wasn't announced until March, that's something that a lot of people are being critical of, because, you know, one app is giving you the ability to decide what you want for your kid. Maybe you do want a 4-day week for your kid, or maybe you don't want a 4-day week for your kid. And that choice was kind of taken away by not announcing this change until so late. So we asked the district if they were going to, you know, allow people to transfer, and they said there's not really a transfer process until October 1st. So if parents don't like this announcement, they can apply in the second round of 1-app to transfer to, or to get reassigned to a new school.
What's the response to this 4-day school week proposal or plan been from the overall education community in New Orleans?
We actually heard from a former district employee at the Tuesday school board meeting. She's also been a parent in Orleans Parish for years, and she just thought it, you know, this wasn't quite a fair time to tell parents about it. So we've got some tape here.
There needs to be a timeline, preferably in the fall, when charters are publishing their schedules. It is not fair to the King parents and children for them to all of a sudden to publish that they're doing a 4-day calendar week when round one of the one app is closed and round two, it's just not transparent for families to have to scramble and figure that out in May when round one of the one app closed in January.
That was Lana Hinkins, who formerly worked for the Orleans Parish School Board and the Recovery School District. Have you heard similar concerns to the ones that she's raised?
Definitely. She acts as a voice, I think, for other parents in the community, and she brings experience and the tact to kind of bring those comments forward to the board, and they listen when she speaks.
Marta Jusen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On Thursday, the New Orleans City Council cleared the way for a Bywater housing development that would provide 82 affordable housing units. Supporters say the move will help address issues of gentrification and segregation in the Bywater, while opponents fear the building will turn into a, quote, isolating ghetto in a neighborhood of single and double family homes. I'm here with Michael Isaac Stein. Michael, what did the City Council approve on Thursday?
So the City Council approved a zoning change that would allow this new affordable housing development to be built in Bywater. The development has been in the works for a long time. It would be a 4-story structure, pretty large. It would have 136 total units. But yeah, so basically as it stands, that plot of land right now, it's just kind of this big open grass field with some old oak trees on it. It was split zoned between two different designations, but one of them, so basically half of this property, would only allow residential units that were under 4 units each. So you couldn't build this type of development there. So basically they switched it to make sure that this would be possible. And yeah, it passed unanimously. Councilman Joseph Giarrusso wasn't there, but everyone else voted yes.
And you said the deal has been in the works for a few years now. It almost fell apart in the last few weeks. So how did it finally come together?
So a couple weeks ago, Councilwoman Kristen Palmer sent a letter that basically stated her opposition to the project as it was written. And that was pretty key because this is going to, if it is built, it will be in her district. And usually when it comes to land use matters like this, the council will defer to the council member in whose district the development will be. So basically, you know, this had everyone scrambling at the last minute to try and find a solution. Her biggest two issues were, number one, was the zoning change being that the City Planning Commission had recommended. It would have allowed, I think, up to something like 192 units to be built, which is bigger than the development as it's proposed. But she was saying that, okay, well, you know, this development, it's a collaboration between the Housing Authority of New Orleans and this private development company from Houston called ITEX Group. And basically she said, since the zoning will allow them to build a bigger building, there's nothing really stopping them from doing that. So, you know, she was basically worried about losing the control over how big the building would be. Her other problem, you know, it was more of this, how much can we control this building? She pointed to problems in the past when affordable housing units are built by private developers. She talked about how certain livability aspects of the development can be ignored, you know, simple things like creating a sheltered bus stop or things like that. So she wanted the council to have more control. She put forward a motion on Thursday, which also passed, which basically opens this process that will allow the city council to put provisos on the development. So, you know, anything from they can say this cannot be over 4 stories. Like I said, you have to have a covered bus stop, things like that. So with that motion, the city council got a lot more control. And I think that kind of made Palmer and the rest of the council more comfortable to go forward.
So the city council is comfortable, but zoning changes in residential areas are often met with criticism. People who own in an area might worry that their property values will be affected. So what are residents in the Bywater saying?
You can't really paint over all the residents with a broad stroke, obviously. And there's a mix of opinions, but there has been a very, very loud voice of opposition. This organization called Neighbors First for Bywater has been very vocal in their opposition. And there's a few different things they say. I think the main one is that you know, they've called it like a monolith and a megastructure that would stick out in Bywater, where it's dominated by single and double family homes. So there's conversation about how that will affect, first of all, the people in the development. They say that, okay, we're for affordable housing, but we don't want, you know, these low-income residents to be kind of walled off from the rest of the community. You know, we don't want that intra-community division. The other thing that's been said is that people are worried about crime. People have brought up, you know, other larger affordable housing units, housing projects in the past that had problems with crime. So those were the main complaints that were brought forward. You know, there were some critiques on those critiques that were brought up even by some council members yesterday. The language got a little bit ugly, at least to hear council members tell it.
Yeah, some opponents of the housing plan have been criticized for comments that some people thought were racist and for having a general not in my backyard attitude. You know, everyone says they're in support of affordable housing until the affordable housing is next door.
Right. I mean, there's been calls of NIMBYism, you know, not in my backyard kind of attitude here. There have been charges of racial animus. The Southern Poverty Law Center actually sent out an email charging some of the opponents with racial animus. And it's hard to know what people are thinking and what their intentions are. But there are definitely a lot of people who say that these opponents are driven by sort of racist fears of crime and what that would bring to their community. And actually, you know, during the vote, Jay Banks kind of went on this long tirade about how he was very concerned about how people were talking about this. And, you know, saying that people are looking at affordable housing like it's a dirty word and that it's going to bring, you know, negative elements to a community when that isn't true. So that certainly has been raised a lot of times. I mean, I think there are also people who oppose this project who are not coming from a racist standpoint. But I think, you know, you do see that certainly.
You know, and the Bywater especially has been kind of a flashpoint in the city's bigger discussion of gentrification. Before Katrina, the area was majority Black. Now it's only about 25%. What about proponents of affordable housing? What are they saying?
Yeah, and, you know, before going into what affordable housing advocates are saying, I think, you know, one really important point here is that, you know, while community groups in Bywater might be opposed to this, I think a point that's been brought up is that this project in many ways is being built for people who were in that community who are no longer there. So in that sense, it's hard to get representation from a part of this community that's no longer in the community, right? They've been pushed out. So the question is, are these community groups within Bywater representative of the Bywater that people have, you know, that people want to bring back almost, you know, a very diverse in terms of race and income kind of community? The housing advocates are saying, you know, it's important to get input from people who live in the community, but it's also important to consider people who would like to move back here, people who grew up here, who no longer can afford to be here. I think another point that's been brought up is for people who live in the Bywater, it's you live in this great community with a lot of amenities, and, you know, you can understand why someone wouldn't want a large building next to their home. It's an understandable thing, but I think some of the attitude almost seems to be, well, get over it. You know, we're dealing with bigger things here. People not being able to live in their own community is a bigger deal than you not loving the architecture near your house. So I think that's been a common argument. And then, like we said in the beginning, this thing has been in the works for years and years now. And it's just so hard to get one of these projects through because it's no longer how it used to be where you just got government funding and you built affordable permanent affordable housing units. Now the funding mechanism for it's like a Frankenstein of different funding mechanisms. You bring in federal tax credits and Section 8 vouchers and market rate, you know, units to subsidize the affordable housing. So it's a very complicated thing. And residents in the Bywater who are opposed to this project who are like, well, we want affordable housing. Let's just do a different kind of project. I think affordable housing advocates who have been involved in this process are like, it's not that simple.
What happens now? Is this deal finalized?
No, not even close. There's a lot that has to still happen. I don't have a complete list, but there are at least, you know, off the top of my head, six different steps, you know, pretty significant steps that need to be taken. Like I said, on Thursday, the council voted to initiate this plan development process that gives them more control over the project. But part of that is that, you know, they sent a list of things that they want the City Planning Commission to study. So now they have to go back and write up this study, pass it through the City Planning Commission. Then the City Council will have to approve it as well. They also called for more community meetings and working groups. And that's not to mention the fact that the tax credits haven't, you know, been finalized yet. Those still need to be applied for and you know, and then obviously you have to build the building, right? So we'll see how the process plays out, but there's still a ways to go.
A long way from the finish line. Michael Isaacstein, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kenneth Charity, a developer and client of the bankrupt First NBC Bank, has been charged with conspiracy to commit bank fraud. He's the third person charged in the case in which the bank was seized by federal regulators in 2017. Lens co-founder Karen Gadbois joins me now. Karen, who is Ken Charity?
Well, Ken Charity is sort of an elusive character. When I first wrote about his shenanigans at the Lake Terrace Mall, he never showed up to be interviewed nor responded to my request for comment. So I can't say that I've ever had much experience with him personally, but he has let his presence be known by sending attorneys to speak on his behalf.
And what's sort of been his role as a developer in New Orleans? What kind of properties has he invested in?
When I first did the story about Mr. Charity, I thought it would be interesting to look at all his properties because in my experience, if someone blights one property, they tend to blight all properties that they own. And what I found was that he had invested several million dollars in properties from the French Quarter to my own neighborhood right off Claiborne Avenue. And that all these properties either had blight judgments against them or were in the process of having blight judgments. Particularly the one by my house is a multi-unit building, which has grass so high you can't you can no longer see the pedestrians as they walk down the sidewalk. It's actually pretty dangerous. So, you know, it seemed to me at the time when I first started reporting on this story that there was an element of bank fraud going on, but since bank records are not publicly accessible, there was no way for me to prove it. Now we know there was.
Yeah, and this case, you know, this blight that you're talking about goes back to around 2013?
It goes back previous to that. And as Lake Terrace neighbors were complaining very loudly to me and to others about this blight, it just seemed like he had no plan or intention to develop these properties. It was really a vehicle for money to exchange hands. And the city has come out from time to time to enforce blight judgments against him for various properties, but it seems nothing moves really.
And when you mention Lake Terrace, you're talking about the Lake Terrace Shopping Center, which apparently Mr. Charity falsified his financial condition and took loans for property development that never happened, one of those being the strip mall at Lake Terrace.
Mm-hmm. He also received a couple hundred thousand dollars from the city of New Orleans to redevelop the site. And that was what I think particularly annoyed the neighbors, that not only was it a blighted mess, but that it was a blighted mess that they had, with their tax dollars, paid to have it renovated or brought back into use. As I said, when I went out to do that story, I was met by Greg St. Angelo, who's an attorney for First NBC, and it just struck me that here we have one of the most powerful attorneys in the employ of First NBC meeting me to discuss a story about one of their clients. It's just not something you see happen every day. The First NBC story really is a giant story that almost deserves its own book, I believe. It's an enormous bank failure in a time when we were supposed to have tidied up that particular mess, proclivity to turn to bank failures as a business model. But I have always said, if you look at a bad development or a development that never happened, chances are it was a First NBC project. Whether or not there's fraud involved in those, I'm not suggesting they're all fraud-based projects. But certainly there was, First NBC was sort of the bank of last resort if you were unable to put together a deal at any of the other banks in town.
The whole situation is really indicative of failed land use deals in the city. First NBC Bank came to be after Katrina, where there was a void, there was a vacuum that needed to be filled. Loans needed to be made so that properties could be rehabilitated. Did that lend itself to some exploitation of the system?
Well, First NBC came into being in 2006. So clearly, 2006 was a time in which, as rapidly as the city had been destroyed, people wanted to see a sort of rapid regeneration of the city. And First NBC was seen as a place where that people could go who may not have been able to bring their projects to fruition could go and be met with opportunities. Certainly, there's a number of them, and I should actually have created a spreadsheet because I jokingly say if there's a project that fails, chances are, you know, it was a First NBC project. Clearly, the oversight wasn't there. I mean, it was nearly a Ponzi scheme of a bank. And the thirst for the community, for politicians to be able to, you know, cut the ribbon and say this thing has happened was great. I mean, people really were hungering for that. And so I think that sometimes people may have looked the other way. Now, I don't know exactly what kind of bank documentation gets submitted to the city when someone applies for public monies to be used for their private projects. But certainly it would seem that that's something that the city would want to consider when someone's asking for what fundamentally, when I went back and looked at what the money had been used for, this $200 and something thousand dollars, it was almost like they paid for the permits. So it was a sort of funny, like a forgiveness program. But also it kind of, I think it had paid for like the renovation of his pool as well. So, you know, it was just a kind of lack of oversight on the city's part, lack of follow through on the developer's part, and a bank that seemed more interested in capitalizing on faulty loans than it did on actually delivering what it was promising.
Mm-hmm. And as a journalist who identified something a little suspicious years ago, how did it feel when you heard the news that that these charges were filed against Mr. Charity?
Well, I always have joked that he was my white whale. It was a great story if there had been the ability to get my hands around the whole first NBC story. I'm always really pleased when I see other reporters reporting on this story, because I do think a billion-dollar bank failure, the largest since 2008, merits a tremendous amount of energy to tell that story, and that it has national consequences, a national story. You know, we're not supposed to have bank failures of that magnitude, and yet we do, and we did, and here we are.
Karen Gadbois, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next Friday. And please consider supporting nonprofit journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org to make a donation today.